Penguin Random House Audio presents The Immeasurable World, Journeys in Desert Places by William Atkins, read for you by Jonathan Cowley. 3 days it's been without a trace of him, his nag, his leather shield, his lance or his armour. It's my belief, as sure as I was born to die, that his brain's been turned by those damned chivalry books of his he reads all the time. I remember often hearing him say to himself that he wanted to be a knight-errant and go off in search of adventures. The devil take all those books, and Barabbas take them too, for scrambling the finest mind in all La Mancha. Cervantes, Don Quixote. Translation, J. Rutherford. Prologue. It was the night of the blood moon. The term was coined by Bible Belt millenarians who believe the phenomenon, a lunar eclipse when the full moon is at its perigee, therefore magnified and pink, portended Armageddon. Joel 2:31. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. The timing was just good fortune, but it turned out I'd have among the best views on earth. In my ignorance, it was its redness I anticipated as much as its bigness, or for that matter, the fact that it would be eclipsed. And so when it rose into view, more embers than blood, I was disappointed. As disappointed as one can ever be by a new-risen full moon. By the time I'd rehydrated my noodles and poured my daily half-beaker of wine, the moon had returned from grey-pink to its customary white, like a fingertip pressed against glass, and every cactus and every shrub and the straw-bale cabin had generated a hard, exclusive shadow. It seemed to me that the chief characteristic of night in the desert was not darkness, but this light that was not the sun's. The cabin stands on a ridge above the San Pedro River, 60 kilometers east of Tucson, Arizona. It is a one-room structure about 3 meters by five, with a door facing northeast. In each of the other three walls is a single window, screened with mesh against insects. It's nice to open the windows to the evening breeze, but during the day they stay shut to keep out the heat. The interior walls are thickly plastered, bumpy and cracked. The floor is packed earth laid with two rugs heavily nibbled by mice. Furniture, a cabinet for cooking utensils, a folding steel cotton mattress, a pine table and matching chairs, and an iron-banded trunk a century old, containing Mexican blankets, batteries, and a first aid kit and dozens of candles. The table resembles an altar. On it, most of the time, stands a storm lantern and a bottle of screw-top Cabernet Merlot, $8.99, Trader Joe's. Each of the four windows, there's one in the door, gives onto a hillside thick with mesquite, palo verde, creosote bush, ocotillo, prickly pear, barrel cactus, and saguaro, the region's characteristic cactus, the cactus of cowboy films. It is the saguaro's giant candelabra forms that break the line of each hillside and provide landmarks. The tallest for kilometers stands beside the cabin. From the southwest-facing window, you can see the Rincon Mountains, with the Little Rincons before them, dropping down to the San Pedro Valley, and the few dwellings of the Cascabel community 10 kilometers away. When the sun rises behind me, a blade of light drops from the distant peaks of the Rincons, down the foothills and towards me across the alluvial plain, until slowly, like a lava flow, the threshold where light meets shadow approaches the cabin. And then, there. The warmth, as the sun's rays touch the back of my head, and my shadow is thrown down long before me. From a hook fixed to a rafter end, I hang a kettle of water on a bungee each morning, and by 6 p.m. it is hot enough for a shower. On the cabin's opposite side, where there is more shade, lies the 200-litre drum that provides all my water, raised on a bed of rocks and protected against the sun with a jacket of wire-strung saguaro ribs. The ridge separates two washes, dry except after cloudbursts. One is broad and shallow, the other is deep and narrow, and what they call an arroyo. The ridge rises to the northeast. Halfway up this hill, about 30 meters from my door, is a double wooden frame into which two identical square boards are slid, each painted white on one side and on the other red. Every evening, before my shower, though I don't always remember, I walk up the hill along a path marked out with rocks on each side and slide out the boards, flip them over, and slide them back into the framework. From the ridge near his home down near the San Pedro, my friend Daniel checks each morning with his binoculars. If he remembers, if the boards do not change for a day or two, he'll come and make sure I'm okay. There are a few books here. A Natural History of the Sonoran Desert and a book about the dangerous animals of the region. Everyone hair-triggered, you'd be forgiven for inferring, to sting you, bite you, maul you, or char you with its fiery breath. My own contribution is a paperback facsimile of John C. Van Dyke's 1901 book, The Desert. It describes a man's journey, alone into this desert, the Sonoran, a journey made chiefly in 1898, though its precise course is unclear. He was an accomplished art historian, but trust Van Dyke's guidance at your peril. Here he is, homicidally, on the subject of food and water. For instance, any athlete or Indian will tell you that you can travel better without them. They are good things at the end of the trip, but not at the beginning. Rattlesnakes he describes as sluggish. He shoots grey wolves in California, where there were no wolves, and eulogizes the purple flowers of the saguaro, which are white, though the fruits are red. Alerted to certain errors by a well-meaning desert ecologist, he graciously acknowledged the mistakes, promised to correct them in future editions. The desert had a long life, and, so far as is known, made no effort to do so. A note appended to the manuscript of his autobiography spells out his aim: to describe the desert from an aesthetic, not scientific, point of view. I no longer sleep inside, but, after my sunset shower, drag the cot out to the clearing in front of the door, where I am not disturbed by the lizards in the roof, or, more accurately, where the noise they make is subsumed by the larger racket of the desert at night. I lift each of the bed's feet and slip containers of water under them, tin mugs, a wooden saucer, a saucepan, to keep cone-nosed kissing bugs or scorpions from joining me. I position the two chairs beside the bed, one at the foot, one alongside my head, and stand lanterns on them. In a row on the ground between them, half a dozen candles are stationed. In the mornings, the hardened wells around their wicks are black with flying insects. Within this lit perimeter, I sleep more easily than I have for months, which is not to say deeply. Waking in the night to the buzzing of cicadas or the yapping of coyotes, I experience a weight of tranquility that has the quality of a quilt. It might be the peace of the dying. Most afternoons, as the warmth first intensifies, like an oven preheating, then levels off at a temperature that permits nothing but sitting in the cabin's shadow, cowled in a wet scarf, I try to remember how the song goes. High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. One little girl in a pale pink coat heard. This is my main afternoon work, to remember the words. And day by day, one by one, they return to me. Though it's a year since I last heard the song, coming from a cracked Samsung smartphone on the edge of the worst desert on earth, while to the north, a massacre was happening. Chapter 1. The Desert Library. The Empty Quarter, Oman.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?